listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, it's been an interesting month or three leading up to last Friday. I had a half-hour conversation with Guy McPherson. He was on our radio program earlier in the week, you know, basically saying, hey, you know, we're screwed. It's like we're rearranging the chairs and the deck chairs in the Titanic. I'm still not there yet. In fact, I had a couple of interesting conversations with some people who are pretty solid with climate science over the weekend. And they're guessing that Guy he's using the most aggressive math. And there's less aggressive math that indicates that we've got maybe 10 or 15 years to stop using fossil fuels. Now, as Guy pointed out in this program, that would basically mean, well, actually, what he asserted was that would mean the collapse of industrial society. I don't agree with that. I think it would mean the transformation of industrial society. That if we were to move from a fossil fuel-based energy-driven economy to a sunlight-based energy-driven economy, so that wind power, which is a variation on sun power, the winds are caused by the heating of the earth and the rotation of the earth, wind power, wave power, geothermal, That's not sunlight. That's nuclear, I suppose. It's old, you know. But whatever. Geothermal. I'm not in favor of nuclear, by the way. But if we just went with wind, wave, geothermal, and sunlight, and we did it with the enthusiasm and commitment that we went into World War II, or that we built the atomic bomb. We could pull this off. I mean, we defeated the Nazis. If you can defeat Hitler, you can defeat climate change. But I think it's, and I say this apropos of the fact that the IPCC came out with this report last week saying 15 years. And by the way, we're already seeing the effects of this global climate change. All this weird weather all over the world. Welcome to the new normal, and it's going to get worse. And we're 8/10 of a degree warmer than baseline, than, you know, pre-industrial civilization. And so there's probably about that much still baked into the cake that we're going to get, whether we like it or not. What are we going to do about that? I think there are a couple of things that we need to be talking about and talking about clearly and loudly. One is that the global warming denying, This idiot, Jim Bridenstine, I think his name is, who was standing on the floor of the House of Representatives representing the oligarchs of Oklahoma last week, saying, we know there's, you know, global warming, you know, the earth hasn't warmed in the last 10 years and it only goes up or down based on solar radiation. I mean, either this guy is, and his ilk, I mean, you know, it's him and a few thousand others who are out there talking loudly, and then, you know, the millions of Americans who watch them on Fox News or whatever and go, or listen to right-wing talk radio. Either he's being paid really well to say things that are going to lead to the death of future generations and that are causing the death right now of people. He's being paid really well to have blood on his hands, or he is an all-time world-class idiot for having the stupidity to go on the floor of the House of Representatives as a member of this august body of 435 people. I mean, this is a very small group. And speak authoritatively on an issue that he apparently doesn't know anything about. We need to start calling these people out. We need to start identifying them. We need to start shaming them. We need to, the Koch brothers, their fortune was built on fossil fuel. It continues to be to a large extent. The oil companies have been funding climate change denial. This stuff has now reached the point where you can't just say, oh, you know, it's a debate, or, oh, isn't that funny? No. People are dying. If Ronald Reagan had not stolen the election in 1980 by cutting a deal with the Ayatollah to keep the hostages, Jimmy Carter would have been our president for another 4 years. And Jimmy Carter had put into place the year before that election, had put into place a solar bank in the United States that by 14 years ago, 2000, would have met 20% of our electricity needs, and he was on a course to do it. And his math didn't account for Moore's law, you know, that every 2 years technology doubles, its price cuts in half, and its size cuts in half, and that we would import no more foreign oil. I mean, here's what Jimmy Carter had to say back on July 15th, 1979. This is from the Carter Library.
The energy crisis is real. It is worldwide. It is a clear and present danger to our nation. These are facts, and we simply must face them. What I have to say to you now about energy is simple and vitally important. Point one, I am tonight setting a clear goal for the energy policy of the United States. Beginning this moment, this nation will never use more foreign oil than we did in 1977. Never.
And then the solar bank.
Moreover, I will soon submit legislation to Congress calling for the creation of this nation's first solar bank, which will help us achieve the crucial goal of 20% of our energy coming from solar power by the year 2000.
Now, I remember that speech. And had he been president, I mean, you know, so Reagan comes in, the first thing he does is takes down Carter's solar panels off the roof of the White House. There's another piece to this. The other piece to this is that the McCutcheon case that the Supreme Court ruled on last week was not about free speech. It wasn't even about whether corporations should have free speech or how much money billionaires should be able to give to politicians. It was about what constitutes corruption. Here's what FDR said about what constitutes corruption.
These economic royalists complain that we seek to overthrow the institutions of America. What they really complain of is that we seek to take away their power.
And now the most important part.
Our allegiance to American institutions requires the overthrow of this kind of power.
There you go. So that's, you know, you got Jimmy Carter saying, we're going to do something. You got FDR in the past having said to, you know, the rich guys who are trying to corrupt the country, no, we're going to stop you. And we need to be doing both now. It is time for our allegiance, not just to American institutions of democracy, our allegiance to all life on earth requires the overthrow of the kind of political corruption and power that is represented by McCutcheon and Citizens United, that allows oil billionaires and oil corporations to continue poisoning this planet, possibly making it inhospitable for human life.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So we got a big job. Any suggestions on how to do it? I have some ideas I'll share with you. I'd love to hear yours, too. And Andrew Campbell is on the line with us, senior producer of The Big Picture. Hey, Andrew.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. And the median CEO pay jumped 15% last year to $10.5 million. Average worker didn't even see a cost of living raise. Not good.
Yeah, it's really not good, and it's going to lead into the discussion you were just having before the break about the economic royalists are back in charge. FDR said it a decade ago, but the same holds true today. So we'll be talking to Professor Harvey Kay. He's the professor of democracy and justice studies at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay about it.
And he's going to be the third hour of our radio show today, too, for people who are watching. So it should be very interesting. He's a good guy. Harvey's a really good guy. And, in fact, he wrote what I think is one of the very, very best, if you want to read the history of the American Revolution, read Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. It's just absolutely one of the best history books on the revolutionary era that's ever been written. It's just incredible. In our second block, in our Screwed segment, Nomi Prinz is going to join us.
Yeah, we're going to have Nomi Prinz on. She's a journalist and author, and she is a former employee on Wall Street, so she knows the ins and outs of what's going on over there right now. And we'll be talking to her about the new report that came out last week from Michael Lewis, the author, where he basically alleges that because of certain access to technology that the wealthy elite and Wall Street firms have, the U.S. stock market is rigged in the favor of millionaires and billionaires, and the average Wall Street trader doesn't have a shot, really. And this has a lot to do with high-frequency trading, which has been in the news a lot lately. The FBI and other state governments are looking into high-frequency trading, and we'll see what Nomi has to say about it.
Yeah, it's really basically just a way to skim the cream off the top. You know, that's what they're doing. They're just skim a little tiny piece off the top. It's small enough that nobody notices, but big enough that it actually adds up to billions and billions of dollars a year.
Exactly.
It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. In Block C, the torture report.
Yeah, we'll be talking about the torture report and what the Senate did last week. Last week, a Senate panel, the Intelligence Committee, basically opened the doors for the CIA torture report to be released and declassified. But one of the big issues there is that it's likely that President Obama will leave the declassification process in the hands of the CIA, who did the torturing. So what are the American people really going to learn from a report that's going to be filtered out by the people who committed the crimes? It's very interesting.
Yeah. And then our climate change wars as our daily take.
Yeah, we'll be touching on a bunch of stuff in the daily take, including a new Gallup study that says despite all the evidence, despite all the studies that have been done, a majority of Americans still aren't concerned at all about global warming or climate change. Only just around 33% say that it's a major issue today. It's really stunning that the number is that low.
Yeah. Well, there's. I mean, you know, all of our media, you can't turn on TV without watching an ad for fracking or clean coal or ExxonMobil, we love the world, BP, we cleaned up the Gulf, whatever. This is big bucks for the media, for ABC, CBS, CBS, NBC, CNN, MSNBC, Fox, you name it. You know, there's money to be made, and they're not gonna bite the hand that feeds them.
Exactly.
So, anyhow, Andrew Campbell, senior producer of The Big Picture. Thank you, Andrew.
Thanks, Tom.
We'll see you tonight. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Did you see Ann Curry's special report? I was somewhat dismayed that she had a global warming denier on. this guy who wrote the climate fix. But she also had Jason Box on, who we interviewed. He's been on this program. He was on our TV show, and part of that interview got into the video that we did that you can see over at lasthours.org. And let me encourage you again, if you haven't seen that or if you haven't shared it with as many people as possible, lasthours.org is the website, and you can see the video, or you can go over to YouTube and just plug in Last Hours and it'll come up. And you know, I've been talking about this for a while now, and the media is sort of starting to catch up. So ABC News, Ann Curry did this special report, and she – say what? NBC News. Oh, all the better. She went up to the Arctic Ocean and interviewed an Inuit elder. Their community is falling apart. He's like, you are poisoning our land, and we're not the ones who are burning the fossil fuels. It's you guys. And we can't get our food anymore. I mean, we are changing the earth so dramatically. And these changes are coming home fast. Everybody's been sitting around going, oh, yeah, the IPCC says 2100. You know, it's going to be bad by 21. No, and now they're saying 15 years from now will be may well be a point of no return. And of course, they're always super conservative. I mean, it might be 5 years from now that we hit a point of no return. We need to put a price on carbon now. Step one, at least $100 a ton carbon tax, 100% of which gets cycled back to the consumers, who will, you know, which will create an enormous amount of demand for non-carbon sources of energy. So number two thing we should do, we should outlaw wall warts. Wall warts, there's a real interesting little weird story behind this that was told to me by an engineer back at Clear Channel in Portland. I didn't even know this. But I don't know if you've noticed, but 10, 15, 20 years ago, you buy a radio, you plug it into the wall, you turn it on, it comes on, you turn it off, it goes off. Right? A radio, you know, you fill in the blank, right? A clock radio, small appliance. Now, when you buy these things, you get these wall warts. You get a little transformer that plugs into the wall with a wire that goes to the device. And because that transformer is plugged into the wall all the time, whether the device is on or not, you're continuously drawing power. And by some estimates, between 10 and 15% of all the electricity produced in the United States is wasted because of these wall warts. These little transformers that are plugged into the wall. Now, why did all of a sudden companies start producing these? Because the standard, and I forget the acronym of the organization, but there's an organization that basically says this electronic device is safe to sell. And you'll see their little acronym, you know, their little mark on things. They concluded back 10, 15, 20 years ago that they would no longer need to certify devices that did not contain internal power supplies. So if the power supply was external to the device, then the manufacturer didn't have to go through the cost and expense of getting the device certified. So everybody started making devices that operated with external power supplies, the external power supply being the wall wart. If it had an internal power supply, when you turn it on, it would turn on. But with an external power supply, it's always on, or at least the power supply is. And so the first thing, number one, charge carbon. Number two, outlaw wall warts. Right? Just change those standards back to say, you know, if you want to certify something electronic, you got to certify it whether the power supply is external or internal. I realize this sounds, you know, subtle, nuanced, geeky, wonky, whatever. But we're talking about billions of tons of carbon being emitted into the atmosphere. Every couple of days, presumably, or every few weeks, because of these damn wall warts. And in other countries, by and large, they don't have them. Because they don't have this weird little perverse incentive in the law. In the UK, your electrical outlet by the wall has an on-off switch on it. You turn on the outlet before you plug things into it. Or you turn it off before you turn it off, plug things in, turn it on, turn it off. So we need to do that. We need to take all of our subsidies for oil, and we need to put them behind non-fossil fuel energy sources. And we need to say to the oil companies that money that we are spending protecting your pipelines with our police and our Department of Natural Resources of all the various states, protecting your shipping lanes with our Navy in our Air Force, we are going to charge you for that. And we're going to get back $60, $70, $80, $90 billion out of our defense budget and our national resources budget for the cost of all these things. And the land that you are running these things over that you know, we took and gave to you by eminent domain, we're going to start charging you for that too. So you want to have a pipeline? Fine. It's going to cost you a lot. So these are a few starting points. And of course, have the president just say no to Keystone XL. So, you know, very, very simple things. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We'll be back with your calls right after this. I see a number of people want to get in on this conversation. And also this issue about McCutcheon, it really wasn't about campaign contributions. It really was about what constitutes corruption.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
How much money do you have to give a politician before you start corrupting the process? I would say fairly little. Speaking the truth to multinational corporations, would really rather you didn't know all about. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. By the way, over at pdamerica.org, you can sign that petition to Senator Sanders. We're trying to get 10,000 signatures on this thing to say, Bernie, run as a Democrat for president. You know, be there. Be part of the debates. Let's make this thing happen. You know, let's, you know, bring the real issues in. I mean, Bernie is one of the guys who's talking about, let's get off fossil fuels. He gets it. In fact, he's probably one of the most outspoken who gets it. And he comes from a state where, you know, it's going to be a real challenge. But it can be done. I mean, we had friends of ours, Hal and Shelley Cohen, they were visiting us weekend before last. They live in Vermont. Out in the middle of nowhere, in the woods, on the mountain, and their house is off the grid completely. Always was. I mean, it was one of those houses built back there in 1979 when Jimmy Carter was offering the energy tax credits. And there they are with that house. It can be done. Okay. Jacqueline in Chicago, you disagree with taxing carbon?
Hi, yes.
Why?
I feel like it's only going to hurt poor people who are already struggling to survive within the system.
That's why I said give all the money back to the people. If you were to do that, if we were to do it the way that Sarah Palin did up in Alaska, where every man, woman, and child in the country gets a check, you know, every month that represents their share in even distribution of all the money collected, then everybody starts getting a check for $200, $300, $500 a month as their share of that carbon tax. And it would actually be a whole lot more than it would cost any individual, because you're not, you know, just getting a piece of the action for the carbon that you yourself burn, but you're getting a piece of the action for, you know, all of Coke Industries' carbon, right? I mean, it's being distributed to all of us evenly. And that gives all the citizens of the United States extra money that you can then use to insulate your house, to change over to LED light bulbs, to put solar panels on your roof, all kinds of cool stuff.
But the people who are already poor are the ones who can't afford to switch over, and they're the ones who can't afford to pay the carbon tax, and they're the ones that are hurt most.
No, you're missing. The carbon tax is not paid by you. The carbon tax is paid by ExxonMobil. It is paid by the producers. When they dig the coal out of the ground, they pay the carbon tax on it. When they pump the oil out of the ground, they pay the carbon tax on it. When they frack the gas out of the ground, they pay the carbon tax on it. That money then gets given to you and to all the poor people in America. They start getting checks that are larger than what they're spending on fossil fuels right now, because the total fossil fuel consumption in our nation is much larger. I mean, you know, it's order of magnitude larger than just what all the individuals are using, because we've got industry as well. So we don't give that money to industry. We give it to people, and people then will create demand. So what we're going to do is actually make poor people less poor. In fact, this carbon tax proposal would probably about cut in half the the percentage of people in the United States who are living in poverty just from them getting basically a guaranteed minimum income, which is their share of the carbon tax.
So the tax would be on industry and not the people consuming.
That's correct.
Carbon-based stuff.
That's exactly right. So what happens is, you know, ExxonMobil, they get hit with this tax, and so they start, instead of selling gasoline to you for $4 a gallon, they're going to have to start selling it to you for $6 a gallon. So, gee, your gas cost went up. But that, you know, and plastic costs go up unless it's plastic made out of corn, right? And so now we're seeing a transition to biodegradable plastics and things like that. But yes, your gas cost goes up, but the check that you get in the mail every month is going to be much more than the amount that any individual spends on gasoline, because ExxonMobil is also supplying all the long-haul truckers. Maybe we could work it out so that independent truckers, entrepreneurs, people who have to travel for a living, that they get, you know, perhaps a larger check. I mean, this needs to be calibrated so that people aren't hurt by this. There will be some dislocations of the economy. But basically, all of that money goes to the people. That's the plan. This is why it's actually, I'm calling it a carbon tax. The people who are advocates of this program call it a carbon fee with redistribution, or a carbon fee and rebate. And that's how it works. So, Jacqueline, thanks for the call. I understand your point, but I hope I answered it. Jim, in Alton, Missouri, you've got a few answers on this global warming thing?
Well, as far as the transportation emissions goes, yeah, I think I do. First problem is you have to divorce the automakers from the oil companies,
right?
Which is hard to do. They don't want to go with electric cars because they lose all the money they make from servicing internal combustion engines.
Well, you know, they're actually making that transition, though. I mean, you've got several companies making electric cars. You got a whole bunch of virtually every company now is making hybrid cars, And I don't think servicing the internal combustion engines is a major part of their profit. I mean,
actually, they do make quite a bit of money from that, and yeah. It's one of the reasons why they fought electric cars right up and down the road, because there's nearly no maintenance on an electric motor.
Yeah,
and any internal combustion engine can be run on hydrogen right this minute.
Yep.
The only thing you have to do is change the fuel system.
Yep.
To divorce them, you've used corporate greed to do it. You simply give the tax breaks and whatnot to the car companies and let them pump the gas from their dealerships.
I don't understand.
Well, you can make hydrogen by running electricity through water.
Sure.
You don't have to have one of these fuel cells and all that to run an internal combustion engine on hydrogen. You can run it just from gas, from the hydrogen gas itself.
Right, right.
The only thing you have to do is modify a fuel system to run the car off of that.
Right.
Or the truck.
Right. The problem is that, liquefying hydrogen gas can be a fairly complex process. And if you're not using it as a liquid, then, you know, the amount of hydrogen gas that you can put in a gas tank might power that car for about 30 feet.
Well, no, you would have to put a whole new fuel system in and tank where you could highly pressurize the tank.
Right.
But it's very possible to do.
Yeah. Okay. That's a great suggestion. Thank you, Jim. Dave in Portland, Oregon, you have ideas on this?
I really love the subject matter you're covering today. It's spot on, and everything you said so far is right on. What I want to talk about for a second here is social change. And I think that people have to realize that when they buy gas, where that money is going, it's going into ALEC. It's going into all kinds of horrible things. It's going into wars. It's going into these subsidies, supporting the subsidies for these oil companies through political corruption.
Yep.
And I think that people really have to, if they want to spend their money for social change, getting solar is the thing, because you, first of all, you make your own power, and then you take the money away from the oil companies. I mean, it's a no-brainer, it seems to me.
Yeah.
Everyone just does it.
I'm with you. I mean, but look at how insane this is. Just a month or so ago, they passed a new energy budget, and they had an opportunity to just do away with the $3 billion a year subsidies that we just give the domestic oil industry, where we're writing them checks for $3 billion for the wonderful work that they do pumping oil out of the ground. right? On top of their profits. These are subsidies that go back to the 19th century when we were actually trying to build an industrial economy. And now we can't get them out. I mean, it's going to take some political will, but you're absolutely right, Dave. This is the way to go. Vicky in Mondovi, Wisconsin. Hey, Vicky.
Hi, Tom. I had a question regarding the 33% of adults who feel climate change is of great concern.
Right.
I'm wondering about those polls. Do they reach college age people? Because I'm much more hopeful about college age and high school people than I am about people my age.
I don't have the poll and the breakdown in front of me right now, but I do know that the younger people are, the more they're concerned about global climate change, for a variety of reasons. One, they're more well informed. Two, they trust science. Three, it's their future, right? So probably if that 33% is a total weighted average of everybody in America, it's more like 50 or 60% of young people and 20% of old people. But I'm sorry, I don't have the numbers in front of me. But I get your point, Vicky, and it's something that's worth looking up, and I will do so. Thank you for the call, Janice in Englewood, Colorado, listening on AM 760. Hey, Janice.
Hey, Tom. I in fact met you a couple of years back when you came here to do a book tour, and you had a morning program that you let people sit in on.
Oh, yeah. Great. Okay.
I was the one with the tie-dye and the long hair.
Okay. Thank you. Nice to talk with you again, Janice. Quick point, we're just about out of time here.
I wanted to alert everybody that Captain Paul Watson was on TV over the weekend. I think he was on Al Jazeera, and then he was on Bill Maher. And he was talking about how the oceans are going to die first because of all the pollution, the acid change, and that's where the temperature is changing.
Yes, the oceans have accounted for 90%. They've absorbed 90% of the heat over the last decade that we thought was going to go into the atmosphere. And if they start releasing that heat, like with an El Nino event this summer, we're going to have some really, really wild weather. You're right. I'll have to check that out. Thanks, Janice, for that. Paul Watson, I'll have to check him out.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And more on what can we do? How do we, we can't just sit around and say, all is doomed, pass the beer. No, we got to do something. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, guzzling some water quickly between shots. Tom in Asheville, North Carolina, watching Free Speech TV on the Roku box. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Thanks for having probably the most meaningful forum on any media in America. Appreciate that. I have a comment and a question.
Mm-hmm.
My comment is that I agree totally with the understanding that we are affecting the climate and it could be changing very rapidly. We're in the process of putting some solar collectors on our roof as part of a citywide program that got enlisted a few hundred people to do the same here in Asheville.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing lots of things to try to ameliorate the situation.
Good.
Anyway, I have a question, and please forgive me. It's a little bit off topic, but it's such a burning question with me. I have like about 10 burning questions about affairs out there in the world, and this is one of them. It's about GMOs, and it's basically about the debate about GMOs that is occurring in the country, and especially from the progressive side. Now, let me just say it, and correct me if I'm wrong. What I'm hearing is GMOs are potentially really bad for us because they're affecting the DNA, et cetera, et cetera. And that seems to be the focus in the actual GMO crop. But to me, I feel like progressives are leaving out a very, very important part of this argument, and that is that it's allowing us to pour more pesticides in the land. I mean, GMOs and pesticides are like carrots and peas to
right.
me. And I feel like that is neglected. Does that sound too far off base? Because I never hear that.
Yeah, I don't think it's neglected. I mean, that's the argument that's made against Roundup Ready crops, is that it encourages farmers to just saturate the ground with Roundup, and because the Roundup Ready crops are resistant to it.
Okay.
Yeah. we had a conversation last week about this, about how it's killing off the monarch butterflies.
Well, I just am concerned that we're not raising that point enough. Every time I hear somebody talking about GMOs, I'm not directing this at you. I listen to a variety of progressive shows.
Yeah. No, I think that's an important one. It's a real important one. I mean, I think there's three big issues here. A, people should simply have the right to know what's in their food, whether they're crazy or not. You know, I mean, they should simply have the right to know. So, the GMO labeling is a no-brainer. B is the very important issue that you raise, which is some of these genetically modified organisms are genetically modified to withstand higher levels of herbicide, specifically Roundup typically, and which is causing higher amounts, more larger amounts of herbicide to be used, which is now producing herbicide-resistant weeds and is destroying the earth and the soil and possibly poisoning us. And then C, what happens to us, what happens to other life forms when you start taking genes from animals and putting them in plants, which is what they're doing, and, start tinkering with the genetic code in ways that go way beyond Mendel's square, way beyond just, normal hybridization. And at C, you can argue we don't know the answer to that. And my response to that is, okay, fine, we don't know the answer. I would like to have the right to say, and I don't want to be part of the experiment that finds out the answer, label the damn stuff. So I'm with you, Tom. Thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back, Tom Harmon here with you. Oh, this is interesting. Truth Tweeters tweets out, Reagan stole 80 election. Casey's deal with Bonnie Sauter to keep us hostages. Actually, it wasn't a deal with Bonnie Sauter. Bonnie Sauter tried to release the hostages. It was a deal with Khomeini, with the Ayatollah. And Bonnie Sauter ran for president in the summer of 1980 on the platform of releasing the hostages, won with over 70% of the vote. He wrote about it in the Christian Science Monitor in March of last year, and it's still on their website. You can easily find it with a search engine. And he says, I went to the Ayatollahs and said, let's release the hostages. They said, no, you can't do that. We cut a deal with the Reagan campaign. So, but good tweet there, Truth Tweeters. Kelly Watson, why haven't they been sent to The Hague, or at Kelly Watson? Good one. And in our chat room, thank you, Glenn Synapse, for your kind words. And the old transformer Walmart is nearly extinct. They have a transformer and a capacitor. Yeah, this power supply is illegal. Spiffy Dem is talking about this stuff. Yeah, people get what I'm talking about. Okay, so you all know what's going on. Well, let's get back to the phone then. Karen, in Aylett, Virginia. Am I saying that right, Karen?
Yes, it's Aylett, Virginia. Yeah, I was just all of this, and I watch a lot of different shows, and I'm angry about a lot of different issues, and I just wonder, what do you do? I mean, what do we really do? They say try to, get your local people into government, but by the time they get to Congress or the House or the Senate or wherever, it's corrupted. I mean, I feel like we're running without a government at all, and by the time anybody good gets in there, they're swallowed up by the vultures that are there, and I can't see any change happening without stopping and getting term limits to get the people out so that, and let
term,
them go
term
have
limits,
a job.
Term limits is not the solution, Karen, because then you have that creates two problems. Number one, you get bad people who are replaced by worse people, and number two, with term limits, and there's a long history that proves that this is the case. When new people come into Congress, the first question is, how does this place work, right? And the people who've been there for 10, 20 years take them under their wing and say, here's how this place works. Here's how you write a bill. Here's how here's how you make things. Here's where the levers of power are, basically. If you term limit everybody, the permanent institution, that infrastructure that helps the newbies, becomes the lobbyists. They take over that role. And we've seen this in state legislature after state legislature. When you have term limits, what you end up with is progressively more incompetent and more beholden to the to the institutional structures of lobbyists, members of Congress. But I agree with you. This is not something that we're going to solve purely by the political process. This has to be a people's movement. We have to have people out in the streets, literally and metaphorically, you know, out on the internet, responding to everything, everywhere, all the time, talking about this. If everybody listening to or watching this program, you know, made it their mission over the course of the next month to just wake up 10 people or 5 people. Thorsten Veblen, back in the early part of the 20th century, put forward this theory that if you could influence 20% of the population, you could flip a country. And that, in fact, that's how it had always worked. Jimmy Carter wrote a book about the American Revolution. And at the time of the American Revolution, just a little over a third of the people who of the white men who made the decision and fought the war, who lived in North America, were in favor of separating from England. It was not even a majority. It wasn't even 50%. And yet they were able to make it happen. We don't have to sit around and wait for some sort of massive absolute majority. We just need to wake up a critical mass, that early adopter, you know, early mass market critical mass, that 20%, Thorsten Veblen's 20%. And that means talking to friends, talking to neighbors, getting involved. If you go to lasthours.org, we've got links to a bunch of organizations that are working on climate change stuff. There, you know, there's the obvious ones, you know, Bill McKibben's 350.org. Most of the nature organizations now, this is bubbled up to the top of their list. And then just, you know, your general political organizations, Progressive Democrats of America, this is at the top of their list, pdamerica.org. Move to amend, even. If we could get money out of politics by amending the Constitution, then there's a very, very good chance we could get decent legislation out of Congress,
right?
Because they wouldn't
right.
be beholden to the oil billionaires anymore. The oil billionaires wouldn't be able to give them money. So,
well, exactly that, and the fracking and stopping all of that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
I live in a farm area community, and my dog can't stay in my home anymore. He has to go with my husband over the road because the grass, the ground, whatever seepage is coming through from the GMO and whatever they're spraying it with makes her feet bloody.
Oh, geez.
Literally bloody, and our well waters are going non-potable.
I am so sorry to hear that. Are they
yeah,
fracking
I mean,
nearby,
it's,
or is it is it
pandemic?
Is it industrial agriculture or fracking?
It's industrial agriculture.
Wow, that's
yeah, incredible. And they're doing it for soybean and corn for fuel or whatever
yeah.
thing is.
Yeah, well, and part of it's going for animal feed too. If we all became vegetarians, we'd lighten our carbon load a lot too, but that's a whole nother rant. I mean, there's so many small things that we can do, but the main thing is, you know, I think you were the person who started out saying that you're upset about a lot of these things, or maybe it was the person who called before. But
no, I'm upset about a lot of these.
Yeah,
things.
Okay. Well, channel that emotion into action. That's that. You know, the antidote to the thing that eliminates despair is action. The thing that transforms anger and negative emotions is action, and it transforms them into optimism and activity. And the more you can do, the more people you can reach out to, the more, you know, we can change the world. We can do this. We can pull this thing off. We defeated Hitler. We succeeded in freeing the slaves and giving, you know, getting the vote for women. And you know, America has come so far, and we have been through such hell on many occasions. And I don't want to sound totally jingoistic, but I really think that there's nothing that we can't do if we really set our minds to it. And we can become the example for the planet. We're producing a quarter of the world's pollution, carbon pollution, and we're only about 4% of the world's population. We can change that, and then we can be the example for everybody else. We just have to do it. Karen, thank you for the call. Thanks so much. And I'm so sorry to hear about what's happening to your farm or your house out there near the farms. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. And this is sports radio host apologizes for criticizing baseball players' paternity leave. Daniel Murphy's the second baseman with the New York Mets. And he decided to take some time off because his wife had a kid. Or he and his wife had a kid. And he and his union had negotiated a contract which gave him paternity leave. And isn't that great? And then, you know, Boomer Esiason. Thank you, Jim. Jim knows sports. I don't know sports. Criticized this and then apologized on Friday anyhow. So, you know, what about this paternity leave or maternity leave for that matter? In the entire world, here are the countries that offer no paid maternity or paternity leave. This is it. This is the whole list. Out of the 199 countries or whatever it is in the world, 188, excuse me, here are the countries that have no paid leave. Swaziland, Lesotho, Papua New Guinea, Liberia, and the United States. Really? Carrie Lucas is on the line with us. She's the managing director for the Independent Women's Forum, co-author of Liberty is No War on Women, IWF.org, of course, the website for the Independent Women's Forum. Hey, Carrie, how are you? It's been a while since we've talked.
Hey. Yeah, it has been a while, Tom. Good to be back on the show. Thanks for having me today.
Sure. By the way, are you still living in Europe?
I sure am. I'm now in Berlin.
In Berlin. How is the socialism there?
Well, we've had a beautiful winter and lots of nice warm weather. So I like it. So far, so good. We've been here since September.
Good. In fact, I'm going to be in Germany in a couple of weeks. I lived there for a year, as you know, and I really enjoyed it. So they have, by the way, paid maternity leave. I'm not sure about paternity leave in Germany. So why would IWF or Carrie Lucas, I don't know if you're speaking for yourself or for the organization, be opposed to a government mandating that all companies over a certain size, you know, where it's reasonable, I think, I don't know what the number would be, but I think that collectively we could get together and figure it out, offering paid leave?
Well, because I think that this is a conversation that needs to take place between workers and employers. And I think that one thing it's important to, you know, you just said, and everyone goes, oh, my goodness, you know, there's no maternity leave in the United States.
Paid.
Well, actually,
paid.
There is maternity leave. Most women do get maternity leave. Yes, go on.
No, okay, yeah, I see where you're going. You're saying that in most workplaces, most large employers offer maternity leave, paid maternity leave.
Most small paid employers. There was an interesting, I recently found a Census Bureau report on this that looked at what women do after having their first child and what kind of leave options do they have. Mm-hmm. And 56% of full-time working mothers reported using paid leave, 42% also used unpaid leave, some had access to disability leave, some quit their jobs. You know, it's certainly not totally comprehensive, and it's very different than what would they have in Europe and the kind of one-size-fits-all arrangements that they have. But it's really, you know, we shouldn't assume that this means that all women are just thrown out on the street or have no support after having a baby. Most employers know that it's a good business to offer people benefits, which is why they do. But it's important to also note that there's a big trade-off between benefits and compensation, and it costs money to give benefits, and not everybody wants benefits. A lot of people would rather have more money in their pocket.
Well, you could say that. I mean, what we've seen is the top 1% now own, what, 30% of everything, you know, in the last 12 years, more than 100% of all new income has gone to the top 1%. It's not that, you know, if we can have savings by not offering people paid maternity leave, that the workers are going to get more money. It's that the CEOs they had a 13% increase in pay last year, while the average worker actually saw a decrease in their paycheck. We're now up to $10.3 million a year is average for CEOs in the United States.
Well, there's more than a cost to in just money, although money is important to some people, and some people would prefer to have different options or to provide for themselves in different ways. And of course, there's a lot of women out there who don't want to have kids, so maternity coverage isn't much use to them, and they'd rather have more money in their pocket. Thank you very much. But there's also a cost in the kinds of job opportunities that women have. Here in Europe, yes, they have lengthy, wonderful maternity leave policies, and women often take a year off after having a baby, but they aren't in positions of power. American women are doing much, much better in terms of having good jobs and being in managerial positions. You have 14% of American women workers are managers compared to 15% of American men, while in Europe, just less than 6% of European female workers are managers.
Wait a second. You've got to be really careful when you quote European statistics. I heard a guy from the Competitive Enterprise Institute trying to pull this off on NPR this morning. And if by Europe you're including Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, Turkey, you're including the quote new countries, you know, the former Eastern Bloc countries that now are part of the technically or literally part of the European Union, then yeah, the numbers aren't all that great. If on the other hand you're talking about Western and Northern Europe, those numbers are very different. I mean, look at the percentage of women who are legislators, for example, in the Northern European countries. I mean, you're pushing 40-50% in some places.
Yeah, but almost all women there work for the government. They're not entrepreneurs. They're not out there getting the going for Tesla jobs. And Tom, I mean, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, I have a lot of friends here who work here in Europe. I've now lived in three European countries, and you rarely do see a woman who has a very serious career. In part because, you know, I'm around kids, women who have a lot of babies. I've got a bunch of kids myself. And they don't have to work. They stay home. They don't, you know, when they go back part-time, which, you know, which may be great. And if that's what the left wants, but you should realize that if you're a feminist and you want women to be out there leaning in, then giving them 12 months off a year, every time they have a baby that's really not the way to advance women's careers, especially when you have the expectation. I know I've got a good friend who's a businesswoman, and she says that one of the worst things she has is that there's always this expectation. Oh, you could have a kid at any time. You know, we're not going to give you real responsibility because why would you? You might be gone for 12 months starting 6 months from now. Hmm. That's really weighs on employers' minds. People, I mean, it's only rational. You can make it illegal, but everybody's going to have that in their head.
So it sounds to me like what you're saying, and tell me if I'm misunderstanding this. It sounds to me like what you're saying is that the policy of providing paid maternity leave and generous paid maternity leave, like, you know, 12 months, you know, not 6 weeks, but, you know, really serious maternity leave, that policy leads to more of the kind of 1950s families, you know, the more, quote, traditional families that I thought conservatives and groups like the Independent Women's Forum liked. I mean, wouldn't you want that for the United States?
No, Tom. I want women to do what they want to do. I want women to be able to go.
Well, they don't have to take the leave if they don't want to.
So yeah, but if somebody gives it to you for free and it's the you've already paid, you've essentially made almost no money.
It's not free. Everybody's paying.
Women are already, but it's not even. But remember, Tom, it's not only women who are actually going to take leave. It's also any woman who's walking around and they know you're a risk. So it is a big, it really is. It feeds into that stereotype that women are all going to opt out of the workforce. In the United States, women have a choice to make. They can decide to lean fully in and go and be a CEO, and it's often hard. They've got to make a lot of sacrifices. You think of Melissa Mayer, the woman running Yahoo, had barely any maternity leave. You know, I think that's a really extreme decision, but my goodness, that's her decision. She only wants to start working from home after 2 weeks and then really try to take over her job. Well, you know, that's her right.
But she could make that decision in Germany too.
Yeah, but they don't. I mean, they don't. So
okay. All right. Carrie, thanks. IWF.org, Carrie Lucas. Thank you for being with us today, Carrie. Good talking.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You can read Carrie's writings over at IWF.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 15 minutes past the hour. And John, watching Free Speech TV in Highbridge, New Jersey. Hey, John, what's up?
Hello, Tom. My idea for in order to help this would be with your local and state building codes.
Okay, so we're back to last hour's topic, which is fine. We can do it for the whole day.
I'd help since then. So.
Yeah. I see. It's been 26 minutes. And thank you for that. Just for somebody who might have just tuned in, what we're talking about is what can we do to stop global climate change from making humans extinct?
Right. And so we can now start treating our homes more like shelter instead of the opulence that people go for. You're required now by building code to install geothermal pumps. Your house must be oriented for solar panels to be applied. Every home will have an electric car charging station. When you leave the house, you turn one switch. Non-priority outlets are all turned off. You know, if you look at Michael Reynolds' Earthship, there's all kinds of things like this.
Hmm.
But you could apply it to your local area. If you're in a particularly windy area, every house has an electric turbine. And it's by building code. You know, this is how we're going to build new houses. If you want to put on an addition, as they did with the Americans with Disabilities Act, corporations that were doing improvements had to dedicate a certain percentage to upgrade for disabilities. So if you want to put on a $200,000 addition, you have to set aside $20,000 for environmental upgrades, sustainable material.
Yeah, we've done this before for people in wheelchairs. I mean, we can do this to save the planet.
Right. And right, it costs more money, but instead of having a larger house, you'll have a smaller, sustainable house.
Yeah, yeah.
And just do it with local building codes wherever you are. Also, the cynic in me says if we privatize the sun, which I wouldn't be a fan of, but if you privatized it and let ExxonMobil put a meter on everyone's house,
right,
they'd have solar panels on everyone's house by the end of the weekend.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's...
They charge you for the consumption of it. That's
sure.
That's why they hate it, because the sun is free.
Well, and this is also, I mean, there are some of these large solar installations, you know, where they have all these mirrors and they boil sodium, you know, heat up sodium or sometimes just hot water and run turbines and generate electricity. And they love that kind of thing because it's centralized power and they can feed, you know, 60,000 homes and they can keep people dependent upon a single company and a single wire coming into their house. And I don't think that there's a good economic model there is for governments, you know, for looking at this as the commons, to have a smart grid that, you know, helps every home deal with, you know, times of excess consumption and excess production. And this is what they're doing in Germany. But there's not a good model for business to skim a piece off the top of that action, except for the business of manufacturing and installing solar panels. And maybe running the grid, I don't know, but I really seems to me like this should be the commons. This is the stuff that government should be doing. So,
thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much for the call. I think your point of let's do that via the building code is a good one. And the other, you know, half the electricity in the country right now, roughly half the electricity in the United States is generated by either cooperatives or by state or municipal-owned power plants. In other words, by the people. And about half is generated by private for-profit corporations. And that half that's private for-profit corporations, we need to start, you know, using eminent domain and taking that back, in my opinion. We'll be right back. Tom Hartman here with you, and by the way, the half-hour conversation that I had with Guy McPherson on Friday on the TV show is up over at conversationswithgreatminds.com, and you can why it's in two 12.5-minute segments, and so I guess actually it's a 25-minute conversation, but you can check it out over there, conversationswithgreatminds.com. Tony in Winchester, California. Hey, Tony, what's up?
Yeah, hello.
Hey, you're on the air.
Yeah, Tony, it's funny. I was you're one of the best people around for people. Except there aren't that many people who, you know, really can handle it. You mentioned the mass that's critical of 20%.
Right.
I mean, for us to reach, and yet you got a real, and you know this, 20%. You know, I mean, the number of people that who aren't mediocre or aren't just overwhelmed with what they have to do to take care of everything, very small. So you really have to refine your education. How you get the information in without making people crazy.
Yeah, you're right. If Veblen was a little more nuanced than I was. He talked about influencing the influencers and that there was a much smaller class, and I forget the numbers now, I think 7, 8, 10, 12%, something like that. There's a smaller class of people who have the ability, because of their station in society or the nature of their personality, to influence others more effectively than the average person. And if you can influence the influencers, you don't even have to hit that 20% threshold. And so,
absolutely.
Anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. Except that how are you going to, in other words, waking up the people to, in other words, what the proximity?
I think there's nothing like a big storm whacking you upside the head. Nothing like, California running out of water. Phoenix running dry. The massive typhoon that took out parts of Indonesia, and the Chinese are looking at this going, whoa. You know, they're having huge droughts in China. The extreme weather events that up until the last couple of years everybody basically just thought were outliers, we're now realizing, and the IPCC has now acknowledged, the UN is now saying explicitly, these are no longer outliers. This is the new normal. And it's going to get worse every year because the heat that we're experiencing right now is from carbon that was emitted back 30 and 40 years ago. There's still another, it's just going to get worse every year, even if we stopped everything tomorrow, which we're not doing. So I think that's driving the process. So, but if your point is that we need to get young people involved in this and students, was that the essence of what you wanted to say?
Yeah, why don't you get the comprehensibility of what's out there, at least through the, say people that listen to your program, people that, the students that are, and hopefully something will happen. You know, you see that, you say, oh, maybe they'll do something like 1964 or, the Vietnam War or colored people, maybe they'll do some marches. But there's the forces against those marches now, and the mediocrity of the masses of people. They're afraid. So how do you get through to them?
Well, you just keep working at it. You keep talking. You keep sharing. And thanks for the call. And I think that, like I said, I think nature is going to help us, whether we like it or not. Larry in Chicago, listening on WCPT. What's up, Larry?
Hey, Tom. I have been listening to you for several years, and your conversation you had with Guy McPherson a couple of weeks ago really sort of jump-started me. I had been, from the 80s, I first got involved with, the anti-Contras protests, and I did other things post that, but your conversation with Guy McPherson really sort of freaked me out, so I have decided to jump in and start helping out wherever I can.
Good on you.
Starting with my home, getting those outlets from Zuni Digital and
mm-hmm.
LEDs and all my outlets now for lights.
Great.
And I bought tickets. I'm flying out to D.C. for the April 26th I can't remember the name of it, but there's a big anti-Keystone XL protest in D.C. on the 26th of April.
Oh, that's great. I'm going to have to track that down.
Yeah, you can go to 350.org.
Okay, so
and they'll
Bill's putting
talk
it together.
About it there.
Yeah. In fact, we should get Bill on to talk about it, Bill McKibben.
Yes, and I'm going to get involved with the group here in Chicago. I went to the first meeting that's working to help the city divest from fossil fuels.
Great.
So that these things can be done. It's just a matter of saying, I'm tired of sitting on the sidelines, and I'm ready to go. And I have Facebook, all this stuff, just to give you know, let people know, hey, this is serious, you know, and I'm hoping that enough people will pick up. And I do get positive responses from people saying, yeah, I know, I've been thinking about the same thing.
Yeah. Well, good on you, Larry. And in fact, do you have a copy of my book, The Crash of 2016?
I don't.
May I give you one?
Absolutely.
Okay. You're our book winner for the day, our caller of the day. I'm going to put you on hold, Larry. And he's on line two, Danielle. And she will get your address, and I'll sign a book, and we'll send it off to you. Because, you know, it's like it's so nice to hear somebody say, yeah, I'm going to get off my butt and do something. I mean, that is what we all absolutely have to be doing. And we have to be doing it now. Because, you know, we just can't, you know, it's not going to be enough to say, oh, well, we'll wait until 2016 and then we'll get another president. And then what? No. We've got to do it now. And we need to be changing the dynamics. We need to be putting our thumb on the scale of the economics of carbon. We need to do that with a carbon tax and rebate program, or a carbon fee and rebate program, where the fossil fuel industry basically pays, you know, $100 a ton or more for the fossil fuel that they're pumping out. And that wouldn't even begin remediation, right? I mean, charge them $400 a ton to pay for the past damage and then distribute that money to the people.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And then people can use that to buy LED lights and, you know, electric cars and things. I mean, on it goes. Out of the very, very gravulently ugly, brought to you by the Organic Wine Company, ecowine.com. The good, not a bug splat. Yeah, the art project has installed a huge poster of a young child in a field in northern Pakistan, a region that has been the target of hundreds, if not thousands, of American drone strikes over the past few years. The people behind Not a Bug Splat hope that the picture will remind American drone operators of the civilian toll of the drone wars, and say that the picture is big enough to be seen by satellites. War, especially a war fought remotely, is inherently dehumanizing. Good on the people behind No Bug Splat, or Not a Bug Splat, for reminding us that our actions abroad do have a human impact. The bad. Congressman Louis Gohmert. While most of the country is appalled that Mississippi has passed an anti-gay law that would let business owners discriminate against LGBT customers, Congressman Gohmert is proud of the Magnolia State. In a recent appearance on Tony Perkins' Washington Watch, he told Mississippi's governor, Phil Bryant, that his signing of the anti-gay law is a perfect example of freedom. Check it out.
We are so proud. You have set such a wonderful example of real freedom. And you've seen it firsthand. There's nobody more intolerant than in this country than those that are screaming for tolerance.
In Louis Gohmert's America, real freedom apparently means the freedom to treat people differently than the people who are different than you, as if they were second-class citizens. George Wallace called Louis. He wants his platform back. And the very, very ugly Michael Hayden. During an appearance on Fox News Sunday yesterday, the former CIA director blasted California Senator Dianne Feinstein for her role in putting together a report critical of the CIA's torture program. Hayden said the senator wasn't capable of being objective. Take a look.
Senator Feinstein wanted a report so scathing that it would ensure that an un-American, brutal program of detention and interrogation would never again be considered or permitted. Now, that sentence, that motivation for the report, Chris, may show deep emotional feeling on the part of the senator, but I don't think it leads you to an objective report.
In other words, Michael Hayden thinks Dianne Feinstein is too emotional to investigate the CIA. That's incredibly sexist and very, very ugly. That's mind-bogglingly ugly. Lynn in Muskegon, Michigan. Hey, Lynn, thanks for listening to Sirius. You wanted to weigh in on maternity and paternity leave?
Yes, thanks. And I also watch you on Free Speech TV.
Oh, great.
And I really enjoy your show. Yeah, as a woman working in the service industry all my life and living in a poor part of town, women struggle every single day. And if you put them out of work when they get pregnant, which we do, they are out of the workforce. You have removed a good chunk of the population out of the workforce. They can't afford to go back to work because no one helps them with childcare. And if they do, then who's taking care of the children? In a country where we say, family values, we should be putting the family first by giving parents time to bond with their children when they're young. If we continue down this path of raising unhappy children, you know, our happiness rating is, what, 17th in the world? I don't know what it is, but what good is freedom if no one is happy, if everyone is you know, experiencing suicide rates that are gun violence, that all that are escalating, because we're not putting family first. We're putting family last. We're putting money above everything else, and our children can't look up to that. There's nothing for them to look up to.
Yeah, I agree with you, Lynn.
Worship money.
And in fact, I think that we need to redefine freedom. FDR did a brilliant job of it, and Harvey Kay is going to be with us in the next hour to talk about this. FDR in his I think it was his his acceptance speech in July of 1936 for his renomination. He said, an old judge once said that a necessitous man is not a free man. In other words, you're not free if you're hungry. You're not free if you're jobless. You're not free if you're homeless. The conservatives can call all those things freedom, and that's the essence of you know, the libertarian Rand Paul platform is, hey, you don't have health care? Ho-ho, you're free to die in the street. But if you don't have maternity or paternity leave, I would say that your freedom has been diminished a little bit. And so I'm with you. Lynn, thanks a lot for the call. Excellent point. Josh in Springville, Pennsylvania. You want to talk about climate change, Josh?
Well, we actually touched on a few topics. I'm up here right in the threshold of the fracking that's going on. But
oh my.
Yes, I did really want to touch in on the approach to finding ourselves, really being able to impact any type of global change. I just really believe, having had done a lot of outreach programs in college and being in the military, seeing the how effects take change and how things actually happen. There's people that want to talk about things, and there's being effective. And I really believe that, you know, climate change takes a lot of sacrifice from a lot of people that don't want to do that. And, you know, whether it's spending gas or driving big SUVs or whatnot, the way that we change the things about us that we don't like are through our children. I really believe that gentleman that was on early talking about reaching, you know, the younger groups and having them push it. Just, I mean, look at cigarettes, how that's fallen off.
Yeah.
You know, children today in school think it's disgusting to smoke. You know, I grew up in a household. I was a collegiate athlete, but my parents were both chimneys, you know.
Yeah.
And now that's, like, definitely shunned upon. But because of that action, and that's a class 4 drug, so because of that, the children are really a powerful entity. Even in the consumer markets, you see children being able to push, the consumers, what they have, you know, how they buy, and how there's a lot of market development that's out there on using children as a target. So I think that community service groups like Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, it was huge. Boy Scouts in the Army. These are the only ways that we're going to change globally, because people will change for their children, you know.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's some sort of approach. But back to the topic of the fracking. You know, it was funny, you know, for a while they were real busy out here in Northeast PA fracking. In the beginning, you know, people were lighting their faucets on fire. That was true.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And, you know, we'd hear little discussions at the gas stations, grabbing coffee, the stories that would really just blow your mind. And the next thing you know, you're seeing a movie on it, in regards to it. And
yeah, Gasland.
Validating it.
Josh Fox. Yeah.
So, in the end, I believe that, we have to pay attention to our environment. This was the first or the most coldest winter we've ever had in Pennsylvania. It was insane. It snowed yesterday.
Yeah.
I mean, it's out of control.
Yeah, it is. And it's because the Arctic air is slipping, and the Arctic air is slipping because the temperature differential between our latitudes and the Arctic latitudes has degraded because of global warming. And so, you know, get ready for more of this in the future. And we've got to start getting active. Josh, I'm totally with you. Thank you. Excellent points, all. Eric in Hollywood, California. Hey, Eric.
Yeah. I've been proud of
of what we did here in Los Angeles, and it was the state of California pass laws that forced Detroit. It was a tremendous battle, and we did it. We
to get rid of smog.
Detroit.
Yeah, I remember 1973. I rented a little airplane, Cherokee Aero, Cherokee 4175 Tango, and Louise and I flew that thing from Lansing, Michigan, out to Los Angeles. And I remember when we came over the mountains and we looked, and there's Los Angeles, and it was like this giant yellowish dome over it. It was so thick, you know. It was like landing into a cloud, going into the Burbank Airport. And you don't see that anymore. You guys actually did clean up the smog problem.
And the rest of the world followed suit.
Yep. So now California has a real crisis with water, and it's a consequence of global warming. And so is California going to lead the world again? We'll see. I hope so. I'm very optimistic about it. I think that people are starting to wake up and they're starting to get motivated. Excellent point, Eric, and may you be part of leading the way. Thanks for the call. Keep it simple, stupid kid, in Yucca Valley, California. Hey, what's up?
Oh, thanks, Tom, for that great introduction. That's what I wanted you to say. You know, you just talked to a man from L.A., and that's why I called. You know, I call it environmental destruction. It's a slow, like a drip. Unintended consequences, and this is right about smog. In the 60s, I worked for the Forest Service. We had, I'm going to be quick with this, because I know and shout out to Marge, our pantsuit attorney. Anyhow, we had experimental tree farms up in those mountains you flew over, to see what the smog was having the effect on the needle pines.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I yakked with the guys over at the couple of years I worked for the Forest Service about it, and they said, what's happening is the particulates and the unburned hydrocarbon, the oily substances, are coating the needles and suffocating the trees. Okay, I leave the Peter Principle USDA, and I move up to 7,000 feet elevation up in the piney woods. Those mountains you flew over, up in Big Bear Lake.
Right.
And the mountain from L.A. knows, okay, oh, here I hear the music.
Yeah, you got to wrap it up here, kid.
Anyhow, the unintended consequences, the bark beetles.
Oh, yeah, the bark beetles came along because the trees were weakened, you know? It's, yeah, amazing. Thanks a lot for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Living systems, and our Earth is a living system, are so complex that it's almost impossible to predict what's going to happen. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, the Westboro Baptist Church showed up in Moore, Oklahoma. This is the town that got leveled by the hurricane. And they said that it was, you know, God leveled this town because America tolerates gay people. And the people in Moore, Oklahoma got together and, shall we say, ran the Westboro Baptist Church folks out of town? That would be putting it charitably. Very interesting. Paul in Lucerne, California. Hey, Paul.
Hey, Tom. Speaking to your point earlier about all social change being, you know, the few dragging the kicking, the many kicking and screaming.
Yeah, but driving movement politics, movement action driving everything from the bottom up. Yeah, the J-curve stuff.
Well, speaking of that, do you think that we can reach the J curve fast enough to get this thing going?
I don't think we have a choice. Well, I mean, we really should have. You know, we almost did in 1979, 78 and 79. You had President of the United States Jimmy Carter saying, you know, the energy crisis is real. It is here. It's, in fact, here I've got Jimmy Carter saying it here. You know.
The energy crisis is real. It is worldwide. It is a clear and present danger to our nation.
And he had specific things to do about it. And so, you know, we were there. And then, you know, Reagan, of course, cut a deal with the Ayatollah and then stole the election and took down Carter's. So now, you know, instead of having had, that was what, 1980, well, that was 79 that he gave that speech, but 1980 was, what, 34 years ago? Am I doing my math right? Something like that, 80, 90, 90 yeah, 34 years. And, you know, we could have been so far ahead of this thing right now. But now we've got a, you know, the IPCC says, well, maybe you got 15 years. A Guy McPherson says, nah, you're already toast. I'll go with the 15 years. You know, it's like, we got to do something. We got to do something. So, Paul.
That's the one.
Okay.
That's the one right there.
Okay. Yeah, we got to do it. Thank you, Paul, for the call. Linda in Spokane, Washington. Hey, Linda.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I just wanted to reassess history, which doesn't hurt. But before Prohibition, there were hard-working farmers that were running their farm machinery on moonshine, on alcohol, and on Mythbusters, which I don't normally watch. But I saw this episode where they ran modern vehicles without changing a thing about them on moonshine.
Yeah. Oh yeah, the conversion, and this is a big deal down in Brazil because about half of all the cars in Brazil run on alcohol rather than gasoline. And to convert your car over to ethanol, or methanol, depending on how you're getting it or where, whatever it is, to alcohol, the only thing that you have to do basically, I mean, is a small carburetor change if it's a carbureted engine. But the main thing is there are some types of plastic tubing that are resistant to gasoline but dissolve in the presence of alcohol, and you have to replace them. And that's like maybe $35 worth of little hoses and things, you know, and that's about it. So,
yes, but we have to realize that plastic is part of the problem, and it would be good to
switch
over.
Oh, yeah. I'm with you. Linda, thank you very much for the call. See, if we could just get to the point where the only thing we were using petroleum for was to make things like plastics, and then only a small percentage of the plastics. And most of our plastics started being biodegradable plastics made out of corn and things. We'd be so far ahead of the game. 10 minutes before the hour. Wait, it's a gray and rainy day here in Washington, D.C. And so let's bring a little sunlight into that with Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
Well, it's always nice to hear your sunny voice. What's going on in the world?
I appreciate that. Pro-Russian protesters who seized the regional government building in the eastern Ukrainian city of Donetsk are reported to have declared a People's Republic. They have called for a referendum on secession from Ukraine by the 11th of May.
Yikes.
And Ukrainian security officials are being sent to the eastern cities of Donetsk, Luhansk, and Kharkiv after pro-Russia groups occupied government buildings. Interim President Turchinov is calling the unrest an attempt by Russia to dismember Ukraine. He said it was the second wave of a Russian operation to destabilize Ukraine, overthrow the government, and disrupt planned elections. Russia's foreign ministry accused Kiev of blaming Moscow for all its troubles. White House Press Secretary Jay Carney said at the briefing today that I covered that they have strong evidence that some of the protesters were not local, came in from outside, and were paid.
Hmm. So, but the question is by whom? Was it local? You know, were these ethnic Russians who are Ukrainian and they want to rejoin with Russia, or was this, you know, was Vladimir Putin pulling strings? That's the big question.
We couldn't nail him down as to whether it was Putin directly paying them or whether they were being paid in some other less direct way.
I mean, they might have been being paid by a Ukrainian oligarch who would just like those towns to be part of Russia, too. It seems to me that this would be a problem for Putin rather than a solution. I understand Crimea. I mean, he had a huge military base there. But,
right.
But, you know.
Also, my understanding is that even though Donetsk does have a large Russian-speaking population, it also has many Ukrainian speakers.
Opinion polls there have shown considerable support for United Ukraine, and it would not be such an easy switch to go to Russia in that case.
Right.
So it's also interesting that you suddenly all at the same time have these protesters in three separate cities all protesting at the same time. So
yeah, I predict that the next thing you're going to hear coming out of Russia is that these protesters are provocateurs, which is basically the claim that the Ukrainians are making, that they're both going to be claiming that.
I think that's very likely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very likely. The Supreme Court declined today to consider a case involving Christian business owners. You may have already heard this news.
I haven't.
Okay. They declined to consider a case involving Christian business owners in New Mexico who refused to photograph a same-sex ceremony. This is a case that helped inspire the rash of religious freedom bills that popped up this year.
Mm-hmm.
And the case centered on whether a photography business had violated New Mexico's Human Rights Act when it refused to offer its service for a same-sex commitment ceremony. And the New Mexico Supreme Court ruled in August that the business's actions did violate the couple's human rights under state law. So the Supreme Court refused to take up the case, leaving the state high court's decision standing that the business's actions did violate the couple's human rights under state law.
Wow. So, and that basically has the effect of having heard the case, at least for that state.
Effectively.
Yeah. Huh.
Effectively.
Interesting.
A new Gallup poll out today says the percentage of Americans without health insurance dipped to its lowest in nearly 6 years, due in part to the Affordable Care Act. Some 15.6% of Americans lacked health insurance in the first 3 months of 2014, down from a high of 18% in late 2013. Black and low-income Americans saw some of the most pronounced drops in uninsured rates, with declines of more than 3 percentage rates. Hispanics remain the group most likely not to be insured, with more than 1 in 3 individuals lacking coverage, though the level did drop nearly 2 points in the first quarter.
So that's good news.
It's good news. I'm giving you good news today.
Yeah, good, good. More so sunshine.
Far. So far. Well, so far, so good. Half a dozen Senate Democrats called today on a pair of federal agencies to go after electronic cigarette companies that claim their wares can help smokers quit.
Mm-hmm.
Led by Senator Barbara Boxer, the senators single out new ware electronic cigarettes, which proclaimed quit smoking with electronic cigarettes on their website.
Mm-hmm.
They're asking the FDA and the Federal Trade Commission, saying that they can use existing authority to reprimand e-cigarette manufacturers who make unsubstantiated or false claims in their advertising. Meanwhile, the FDA is readying regulations that would bring the e-cigarette industry under its supervision, but a proposed rule has sat under review at the White House since October, so we don't know how long that's going to take. They are taking their time on it.
Yeah. Well, and while they're doing that, this is becoming a very large industry.
Very large industry, well over $1 billion. And wow. With flavors like Peach Schnapps, Cherry Crush, V2 Cola, and Vivid Vanilla.
Wow.
You've got to wonder who the target is.
Yeah. Well, you know, sometimes adults like those kind of kid flavors, but
yeah.
Yeah, I get your point.
Cherry Crush.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Kind of. Kitty Winky.
Yeah.
And an Australian ship did two distinct, long-lasting sounds underwater that are consistent with the pings from aircraft black boxes in a major break in the month-long hunt for the missing Malaysian Airlines jet. The issue is, of course, they're racing to find it. Tomorrow will be 1 month since the plane disappeared, and it's expected that the battery life of these black boxes will expire either today or tomorrow. There is very little time.
Wow. Any idea what the depth of the water is there?
It's about 14,700 feet.
That's deep. That's amazing. Okay, Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you very much.
You have a wonderful day.
Thank you.
And up next here, Harvey Kay. Professor Harvey Kay is going to be with us. We're going to learn all about FDR and democracy and all kinds of cool stuff.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Professor Harvey Kay is here with us. He is a professor of democracy and justice studies. We'll figure this all out during a break in a second here. Professor of democracy and justice studies at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. He's the author of the new book, The Fight for the Four Freedoms, What Made the Greatest Generation Truly Great. And you don't need the headphone right now. We're going to take some calls a little later on in the show, and we'll figure out how to get an earphone into your ear there. But Harvey, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Studio is even better.
Yeah, it's great having you with us. I've been saying for years and years and years that I think that your book, Thomas Paine and the Promise of America, if I'm remembering the title right. Is one of the very best founding era history books that has ever been written.
Thanks. I quote you all the time.
There you go. Well, good. That's good because it's and here we have this. Let's see. What made FDR and the Greatest Generation truly great? Okay, so let me start out. What made FDR and the Greatest Generation truly great?
What made them really great? It's probably the same thing that made the founders great and the folks who fought the Civil War. They came to realize that the only way to defend, sustain, and secure American democracy was to enhance it. And that's what they did. Roosevelt said, we need to make this country radical for a generation. And in the 1930s and the 1940s, they followed his sense of direction and his advice, and they made America radical.
Okay. Hang on. Shane's trying to tell me something.
No?
Pardon?
Hitting the tail.
Yeah. Apparently you've got metal buttons. Your buttons are, it's fine. Just don't bang the table because the microphone's picking it up. I'm sorry.
I'm a professor. I get it.
Yeah. There you go.
I'm taking the jacket off.
Okay. There you go.
Taking the jacket off.
All right. I thought maybe I heard you drop a word that you shouldn't have there. And if so.
Right. Oh, we're actually on.
We're actually on the air,
okay.
And so if so, I wanted to apologize to our listeners because I think that thing went out there. But
it wasn't the word radical, right?
Okay, no, yeah, but it is, but you know,
yes,
I think Shane missed it because we were all fiddling with the jacket. So the Greatest Generation, where are we now? I mean, we're facing crises right now with things like global warming. And, I mean, we've got all these really serious, I mean, genuine crises that the possible extinction of the human race, this is not as big a deal as Hitler. I think it's a bigger deal than Hitler. Is the next greatest generation now coming out of college?
The next greatest generation is latent in our society, latent in American public life.
Right.
The question is whether or not we Americans, those of us your age and our age, will be able to engage those younger folks in doing the kinds of things we've been too long in addressing.
Right.
You know, one of the things that my students at the university always ask me is, what can we do? And they had been so thrilled in 2008 by the possibility of what they believed to have been a progressive candidate running for office, winning the Democratic nomination, winning the presidency. And then they waited. They waited for the call, you might say, and the call to action, whether it was national service or some kind of community action, organizing for democracy, organizing for the environment. And they wanted that call, and maybe we failed to enable that call to come. But it's clearly the case that Obama never made that call.
Right.
And the question is whether or not folks like you and myself, you and I, are we going to be able to encourage that generation to become the next greatest generation?
It's latent within every generation. Isn't
yeah.
It?
See, I believe that almost all of us, even the ones we wouldn't necessarily hang out with, carry around a sort of a memory, a deep memory of the four freedoms. It's American mm-hmm. to believe that the four freedoms is what we need to secure. The problem is we've forgotten how to go about securing it, how to go about making it happen. And so one of the reasons I wrote the book is to remind people about the young men and women in the 30s who confronted the Great Depression, literally threw themselves into addressing and beating the Great Depression. And then when the call came to defend American democratic life, they answered that call against European fascism, German Nazism, Japanese imperialism. But even then, during that war, they didn't stop pushing for greater freedom, equality, and democracy. And in many ways, they pushed Roosevelt themselves. So we can't wait on our leaders to call us. We need to start making noise so that they'll pay attention.
Yeah, I have often thought, when FDR came into office, he, as he described in one of his speeches, 3 years under the cloud or whatever, through 3 years of horror that had passed before he was inaugurated. And when President Obama came into office, it had been, 6 months? And it wasn't enough time for people to realize the gravity of the situation. Yeah, you had Henry Paulson out there shaking, holding his, please pass this legislation. But
just imagine if Obama, at his inauguration, had said to Americans, instead of saying, we're all somehow responsible for this crisis, if he had said, not unlike Roosevelt, we're going to chase the moneylenders from the temple, and I need you to come out for democratic causes. The election's not over, or at least the democratic struggle is not over. I need all of you to join in. Maybe we'd be out there, our young folk would have been out there before the Tea Party got out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's revisit the four freedoms. Let's start at the beginning.
Great.
What are the four freedoms?
The four freedoms, which originate in a speech he delivered on January 6, 1941, a speech which draws on the 8 years of his first two terms and the progressive changes that he and the American people enacted, as you well know. And he said, as he confronted the question of war, we need to become the arsenal of democracy. We need to gird ourselves for the possibilities of war, though he didn't call them yet to war. And then he said, there are those who will say that we should give up our democratic achievements. We should give them up in favor of defense effort, in favor of, if necessary, the war. And he said, no, we need to work all the harder in making this a freer, more equal, and more democratic country. And then he closed that speech, and he said, we look forward to a world founded upon four fundamental or essential human freedoms. Freedom of speech and expression, freedom of worship, freedom from want, freedom from fear. Mm-hmm. And as the reporters said, there were those who didn't applaud. The isolationists didn't applaud his call for the arsenal for democracy. The Republicans generally didn't applaud the call for freedom from want. And apparently the Southern Democrats of that day did not applaud freedom from fear.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
That's very interesting. So there were constituencies that saw his freedoms as contrary to their own interests.
Oh, they realized very well, just as they realized when he took office in the early 30s, and they did everything they could to block the New Deal.
Right.
They knew full well that when Americans heard the four freedoms, they would understand the four freedoms in real, material ways that Within days after he gave the speech, there were women's groups contacting Eleanor Roosevelt to find out what they could do. A. Philip Randolph probably heard the speech and then created, founded, organized the March on Washington movement to demand the integration of the war industries. Labor unions quickly responded to this. I mean, it was actually an extraordinary thing. In fact, I'm going to say something which some people find annoying. I know everyone loves the speech after Pearl Harbor, right? The day that, you know, was an infamous. But I think the real call to the war, which had within it the call to make America even more democratic, was the Four Freedoms speech.
Professor Harvey Kaye is with us. His new book, The Fight for the Four Freedoms, What Made FDR and the Greatest Generation Truly Great. We'll be back with Dr. Kaye in just a moment.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with Professor Harvey Kaye. And we'll be taking your calls, by the way, if you have any questions. I also want to get into Thomas Paine and the American Revolution, all kinds of good stuff. And welcome back. I'm going to play while Professor Kaye and I are figuring out how to get an IFB in his ear so he can hear your calls. I want to play the Four Freedoms speech, the actual speech from Franklin Roosevelt. And here it is.
In the future days, which we seek to make secure, we look forward to a world founded upon four essential human freedoms. The first is freedom of speech and expression everywhere in the world. The second is freedom of every person to worship God in his own way everywhere in the world. The third is freedom from want, which translated into world terms means economic understandings which will secure to every nation a healthy peacetime life for its inhabitants everywhere in the world. The fourth is freedom from fear, which translated into world terms means a worldwide reduction of armaments to such a point and in such a thorough fashion that no nation will be in a position to commit an act of physical aggression against any neighbor anywhere in the world. That is no vision of a distant millennium. It is a definite basis for a kind of world attainable in our own time and generation. That kind of world is the very antithesis of the so-called new order of tyranny which the dictators seek to create with the crash of a bomb. To that new order, we oppose the greater conception, the moral order. A good society is able to face schemes of world domination and foreign revolutions alike without fear. Since the beginning of our American history, we have been engaged in change, in a perpetual, peaceful revolution, a revolution which goes on steadily, quietly, adjusting itself to changing conditions without the concentration camp or the quicklime in the ditch. The world order which we seek is the cooperation of free countries working together in a friendly, civilized society. This nation has placed its destiny in the hands and heads and hearts of its millions of free men and women, and its faith in freedom under the guidance of God.
Franklin Franklin Delano Roosevelt, his Four Freedoms speech. We'll be back with Harvey Kay right after this. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you and Professor Harvey Kay in the studio with us for the hour. And your new book is The Fight for the Four Freedoms. We just heard a little clip of that, FDR, giving that speech.
Right.
Clarify this for me. FDR was governor of New York in the 20s.
28 to 32.
Right. So he was governor of New York. He became governor of New York during the Roaring 20s, when New York was arguably one of the most corrupt states in the nation, and he was the head of a giant political machine, and he did very little to change that. He was, you know, he was a reasonable governor, but he was no crusader. He was not the Caped Crusader. Or was he?
I think historians make a very, very big mistake. They often say, well, Roosevelt really didn't know what he was going to do in the New Deal. It was rhetoric. But if you look closely, there were already initiatives when the panic and depression hit, when the crash occurred. He begins a program not unlike the CCC in New York State. Mm-hmm. He proposes programs up in northern New York near the St. Lawrence, on the St. Lawrence River, not unlike what he will later propose as the Tennessee Valley Authority. He argues in favor of old age pensions for the old age pensions. I mean, he's already testing the waters for what will be the New Deal. So did he clean up New York? No. But he would never fully got into bed, let's say, with the bosses of corruption.
Yeah. Well, where I was going with that is that I'm very skeptical of the great man theory of history.
I'm with you.
That we just have to wait for another FDR to appear on the scene. And I think that great man or woman is within any leader if the parade is big enough. You know, they'll hoist the flag. And FDR didn't really do that until the parade got that big, until the Occupy movement had occupied from the Potomac all the way to the White House, you know, during a couple of years when he was governor and before he became president.
Well, the thing about Roosevelt is, and I think this is something that we should look for, I think we should look for this in all our candidates, whenever we're thinking about who we'll vote for.
Right.
And even then, we got to hold them accountable more than we've ever done in this administration. That is, first of all, Roosevelt had a very, very, a great sense of American history. He himself did not see American history as a story of great men. He actually believed, as that excerpt from the Four Freedoms speech said, he believed American history itself was a revolution, an ongoing, long-lasting, ever-advancing, because Americans were going to make it advance, revolution.
That's a very Jeffersonian concept.
Very Jeffersonian. And he actually, the man whom he sort of worshipped during the 20s before he got directly into the governor's office and later came to the presidency was Jefferson. I could explain that historically, but it was definitely Jefferson. The second thing is he had a tremendous, if you like, belief in America's historic purpose and promise. Now, I know people, liberals, progressives, people on the left, don't like to hear that kind of thing. Historic purpose and promise sounds kind of right-wing. But, you know, for more than 200 years, those who made the case for America's historic purpose and promise, going all the way back to Thomas Paine, were progressives like you and me. Mm-hmm. And the last thing is he had extraordinary confidence in his fellow citizens. He really did believe, to the point of knowing that there was no way he could make history if they didn't make him do it, and he welcomed their doing so. There's a famous story everyone tells in the classroom that a group of reformers came to Washington to meet with FDR and meets with him in the Oval Office, wherever it was in the White House, and they explain their position. They want him to advance legislation, propose legislation for their cause. And what happens? He leans back and he says, "You've persuaded me. Now make me do it." And he didn't mean make me do it. What he really meant was enable me to do it. Make sure that your political representatives cannot say no to when we begin this. So, in essence, press me. We can do this. And by the way, there really is an instance, perfect historical example, when A. Philip Randolph, the black labor and civil rights leader, in 1941 heard the Four Freedoms speech, he began, as I think I mentioned earlier, the March on Washington movement. And Roosevelt really was worried about that march because this was a segregated city. What kind of response white Southerners have to this march. So he tried to get Eleanor to talk Randolph out of holding the march, and Randolph said, no, we're going to do it. And he promised to bring 10,000 marchers to Washington. So Roosevelt figured, well, I better have him come to the White House. I can persuade him, kind of overconfident, maybe. So he and Walter White, who was the head of the NAACP, come to the office. They make their case, and Roosevelt says, how many are you bringing to Washington? And Randolph says, 100,000. And Roosevelt says, then I guess I better do something. And he signs the executive order to create the Fair Employment Practice Committee, which is an effort to push for black integration of the war industries. Mm-hmm. Now, you could leave it at that and say, well, it was Roosevelt knew what was the right thing to do. Randolph went home and said to his closest friends, he said, you know, he was going to do it. He needed to be told what I told him so that people, when they asked him, why did you do it, he said, they were going to bring 100,000 African-Americans to Washington. Who knows what kind of violence might have ensued? So there was this understanding amongst those people who were progressives in their day, as angry and upset and frustrated as they may have gotten, they had a certain confidence themselves that they could push Roosevelt to do the right thing. Not in everything. Southern Democrats controlled Congress. Northern Republicans joined them in a conservative coalition. But through the 30s and beyond, it was a very progressive presidency.
So what has happened now?
That's what my editor kept saying to me. You can't stop the book in 1946.
Right.
You must answer the question, what happened? What happened? Now, I think it's this, you know, confluence of events. First of all the way through the 30s and even World War II, the conservative coalition that had not taken shape until the late 30s stood together against a series of progressive initiatives, including when Roosevelt wanted and progressive Democrats in Congress wanted to enact a law enabling, we can come back to this, enabling GIs overseas to vote. Republicans said, oh, we're not going to vote for this. They'll all vote for FDR. Southern Democrats said, wait, what if black GIs like it? What are we going to do then?
Amazing. Yeah, and there's so many pieces to this, and so many moving pieces. I want to get into that. I want to get to Thomas Paine, and I want to pick up some phone calls. Professor Harvey Kaye with us. We'll be back in just a few minutes, right after this pause for news at the bottom of the
hour. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It's at Harvey J. Kaye. And the book, of course, The Fight for the Four Freedoms by Harvey J. Kaye, Professor Kaye. Welcome back. 28 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, and Professor Harvey Kaye with us, the author of the multiple books, Thomas Paine and the Promise of America, absolutely brilliant history of the founding generation, the founding era, and The Fight for the Four Freedoms, What Made FDR and the Greatest Generation Truly Great, his new book. And it's just some great stuff. Harvey, let's grab a couple of phone calls, and then I want to get – I've got some questions about Thomas Paine, but we've got some folks who've been on hold for a while. I don't want to – so let's – Joan, listening on WBAI in Manhattan. You're on the air with Professor Kaye.
Hi, thanks, Tom. Professor Kaye, you know, I wanted to say that I think you were talking about the hopefulness and the idealism of the young people who elected Obama and were waiting for the call to action from him, and it never came. And I was thinking that it never came because I think he was never a true progressive. And I had that feeling even before he was elected, even before he appointed Geithner and Summers, although that really did it for me. But even before that, in the speeches that he made, if you remember in 2004, the speech that brought him to national prominence, there was a line in there. I listened very carefully to the exact language people use. Mm-hmm. And he said something like, and this is a paraphrase, he said, of course we need government help for people, but we also need personal responsibility. And he put the emphasis on the personal responsibility. If he had said it the other way, you know, of course we need personal responsibility, but we also need government help, government action, that would signify a change in direction. But to me, that was just more of the same direction we've been on since 1980. And speaking of Reagan in 1980, he also said another thing that dismayed me quite a lot was when he was being interviewed by a newspaper editorial board. He said Reagan changed the direction of the country because the people were ready for his message after the excesses of the 60s. And I almost fell off my chair.
I know exactly
and I
what you're talking about.
Yeah. And see, Obama was not old enough to know the excesses of the 60s. You and I are.
Yeah.
Joan, thank you for your comments. Your
observation is excellent. I listen closely too, and I've listened closely ever since the late 70s when I was in grad school. And it amazes me how actually, not to be upsetting, but Democrat after Democrat has failed to issue the call. I mean, I could show you lines in Jimmy Carter's speeches. I know we talked earlier about his commitment to energy reform and the environment in that sense. But he never issued the call to action.
Well, in fact, during the last 2 years of his presidency, Maggie Thatcher came to power in England, and he started deregulating things left and right because that was just like seemed the way the wind was blowing.
Yeah, and if I could tell one other story, which I think Tom will enjoy, as someone who's written about Thomas Jefferson, when I was driving into the university on the day of Bill Clinton's inauguration in 1993.
Right.
Clinton gave, you know, a fairly rousing speech, it seemed, and he was trying to play on his middle name, William Jefferson Clinton. And he had ridden up from Monticello on a bus to reenact Jefferson's own ride on a pony to Washington, D.C. And he had talked about this kind of thing during the campaign. And he, in the middle of the inaugural address, I knew it was all over. Why was that? Because he said, in every generation, Americans demand change. But that's not what Jefferson said. He said in every generation, Americans need a little rebellion.
Yeah.
That would have been the invitation of Americans to say, I need your help in making things happen. Well, when I listened to Barack Obama's inaugural address, he sort of blamed the entire fiscal crisis on all of our doing, that we had somehow failed to live within our means. And I can tell you, the overwhelming majority of Americans not only live within their means, they struggle to live within their means. So I worried about that as well. And when he talks about his grandparents, who mean so much to him, his grandfather served in the tanks, I believe, in the Battle of the Bulge with George Patton. His grandmother worked in an aircraft factory. He said, and after the war, his grandfather came home to the GI Bill, and you know, as if the GI Bill was there waiting. But it was a struggle to get the GI Bill. The GI Bill was based on years of struggle and demands by, oddly enough, by the American Legion. They heard conservative Republicans and Southern Democrats might block it, and they mobilized this conservative veterans organization. They mobilized. And so, you know, I think we should listen carefully in the next year or 2 years. Listen to our candidates. See who's willing to talk about the American radical democratic tradition as well as the benefits of government.
Yeah. Well, Clinton, I'm guessing you're familiar with his New Covenant speech.
Yes,
I am.
That
was his stump speech when he was running in 92, and it was a very progressive speech. He did not govern that way, but he
made the shift at the inaugural address.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and the story is that he made the shift about 2 weeks earlier when Robert Rubin and Larry Summers sat him down and Alan Greenspan sat him down and said, son, here's how the world works. And, you know, and I don't, I personally don't think that's an apocryphal story, although, you know, who knows?
Yeah.
You know, the people who were there are not talking about it. John in Los Alamos, New Mexico, listening on KABQ. You're on the air with Professor Harvey Kay.
Hello. It's an honor to call into your program, Tom. FDR is a hero of mine, and his courage has always impressed me. And I have a question why today in political debates that Democrats and independents seem to be afraid to say it as it is regarding what's happening in terms of class warfare. I think they should, in the vein of FDR's speech, I welcome their hatred.
I love it.
Be able to come forward and say there is class warfare going on, and it has been going on since Reagan's policies, and the rich and powerful corporates are winning. And be able to put that out there and not be afraid of whatever feedback they may get from that, because it seems to be the truth.
There was a good left progressive political scientist in the late 1970s who was British, but he was teaching in the United States for some years. So happens he's passed away, but he was the father of the current leader of the British Labour Party. And he wrote a number of books and coined the term. I don't think beforehand it had been coined quite so precisely. He said, we are entering a period of class war from above. His name was Ralph Miliband. Brilliant writer. Not one of these fancy schmancy writers, but somebody who you didn't have to be a graduate student to understand what he said. And he believed that we were entering into this phase. But I will tell you that it was not just Reagan, as I said before. It began even earlier when the Democratic Party seemed to turn their back on the progressive Democratic tradition of FDR. It began with Gary Hart. It began with Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter was not a fan of Franklin Roosevelt. In fact, the irony, it turned out, was that the person who was quoting FDR during the 1980 campaign was, guess who?
Ronald Reagan.
Ronald Reagan. Of course. And, of course, he also quoted my hero, Thomas Paine. He knew, Reagan, that most Americans were not conservative, that they wanted progressive, and this is all indicated in the surveys of the day, they wanted a progressive politics. They wanted to expand Social Security to include national health care. They wanted public works projects to address the unemployment of the 70s. And Reagan knew it, but he had to somehow capture their imagination, and he had a memory from when he was an FDR Democrat back in the 30s and 40s, and even a Truman Democrat, yeah. And he quoted the very people that he knew Americans would respond to. He upset George Will. Mm. At the Republican National Convention, Reagan quoted Abraham Lincoln, and as FDR once said, the Republicans have given up on him. Let's us Democrats lay claim to him. He quoted Thomas Paine, which annoyed me no end, and Franklin Roosevelt, who I had tremendous admiration for, but only later came to discover just how progressive, if not radical, Roosevelt's mind was. And what did he do? He won the presidency that year, in good part, by the way, because most Americans who might have turned out to vote for Democrats, they just stayed home.
Yeah. I think I have this clip here. This is from the FDR Library. This is from his 1936 Madison Square Garden speech.
Never before in all our history have these forces been so united against one candidate as they stand today. They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
And then the applause goes on, and you can just let this play kind of faintly, Shane. The applause goes on for almost a minute,
yeah.
And then he comes back and he says, and not only do I welcome their hatred, but I'm gonna you know, bend them over my knee. I mean, it's whatever metaphor. I mean,
yeah,
it's just,
right,
we're gonna tan their hide. It's
yeah. Those are especially the American Liberty League folk who I think you've heard of. Right?
Yeah.
The folks who didn't want their taxes raised.
Yeah. And here they're shouting, oh, come on, keep it going, Mr. Roosevelt. And now here he comes back in just a second.
I should like to have it said of my first administration that in it the forces of selfishness and of lust for power met their match. I should like to have it said, wait a minute, I should like to have it said of my second administration that in it these forces met their master.
There you go. Not just their master, but their master. Where is the politics today that can
right.
talk like that? I mean, it just...
I think people expected just that when they heard, yes, we can.
Yeah.
And what we got was maybe not.
Yeah. Or yeah, we can do some things.
Right, we can do some things.
We can do some things.
Right.
We can, you know. But so the question, how do we get to yes, we can, right? And... We will ask Professor Kay that question right after this. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And Professor Harvey Kay is with us. His book, The Fight for the Four Freedoms, What Made FDR and the Greatest Generation for the Good. And welcome back. Paul, listening on KBCS in Woodinville, Washington. You are on the air with Professor Harvey Kay.
Well, hi, Tom. Good afternoon, Professor. My question is this, it's apropos to the title of your book. What about the four bad reasons why the progressive New Deal politics of the Roosevelt administration didn't really take place until his second term. And I mean in the four bad reasons. I mean that in the by way of James McReynolds, Willis Vandenant, or George Sutherland and Pierce Butler, who stood in the way of those policies in his first term. And in my view, we have the exact same. The court makeup is very similar. Of course, they were known collectively as the Four Horsemen of Reaction to the New Deal policies. I think we have the same thing going on right now, which is why the 2014 election is vitally, vitally important for Democrats.
And 2016. But did 2014, if we lose the Senate?
I think 2014 is absolutely crucial for Democrats, though I'd like to imagine we could get more progressives among their number. That's a good question, this idea of the first term. I think we underestimate the first term. I think your point is well made, but I think we underestimate the first term. The National Industrial Recovery Act, which the Supreme Court later declared unconstitutional, and the Agricultural Adjustment Act, which suffered a similar fate, they built into that law, those laws, a guarantee of workers' right to organize and a guarantee that farmers themselves would participate in the decision-making regarding prices and cooperative activities. Now, what happened was big business reacted very quickly and started organizing their own company unions. And Robert Wagner, the great New York senator, he realized this, and then he applied pressure on Congress and on FDR to create the National Labor Relations Act, which is then passed in what some people call the Second New Deal of 1935. So I think we shouldn't underestimate that first term. Plus, he had said to Frances Perkins, his Secretary of Labor, that he wanted her to come to Washington because he had big things to do. And she said, I'll tell you what, I'll go to Washington with you from New York, because she had been the Industrial Commissioner in New York. She said, I'll do that if you promise me we will do Social Security in the first term. And they did in 1935. Remember, the first term ends in 1936. So that first term, they didn't let people stand in their way. But there's something else which we shouldn't forget. I mean, it's too easy to blame Obama and, you know, hold him accountable. He's a president. He's not a king. Roosevelt had some great people in Congress during those years.
Yeah.
George Norris, progressive Republican from Nebraska, who believed in public works and environmental action. Robert La Follette Jr. in Wisconsin, who believed in the rights of labor and who believed, alongside of Robert Wagner, in advancing the New Deal in every way he could, to the point where Franklin Roosevelt backed the progressive Republicans in Wisconsin in elections, not the Democratic Party in that state. Well, and last but not least, the person I've mentioned, the pilot of the New Deal, Robert Wagner. Now, those men helped to make the New Deal and enabled Roosevelt's 8 first years to be as revolutionary in some ways as they became.
So he had somebody basically in the Senate who had the power and gumption of LBJ when he was running. So
right.
That kind of remarkable. We'll be back with more. Professor Harvey K. right after this. Your People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program, and Professor Harvey K. with us, the author of The Fight for the Four Freedoms, What Made FDR and the Greatest Generation Truly Great, and his previous book, one of my favorite American history books, Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. And if you haven't read either of them, you should get both of them. Great, great stuff. Thomas Paine, I don't want to... Well, first of all, you just made a comment. I'd like you to repeat that. That something that significantly differentiated Franklin Roosevelt from Barack Obama is who he had around him.
Right. He had these three senators, as I said, Norris of Nebraska, La Follette of Wisconsin, La Follette Jr., both Republicans, but they were capital P progressive Republicans, mavericks in the party. And eventually in Wisconsin, they actually set up a separate party. And last but by no means least, Robert Wagner, who was magnificent. In fact, during World War II, Wagner and Senator Murray of one of the Dakotas, I think, and Congressman Dingell, the father of the now, is it the father or the grandfather of the retiring congressman from Michigan, they got together and proposed national health care. They knew they couldn't get it through, but they imagined at war's end they could make that happen. I'll tell you something which might come back to the Thomas Paine. I wrote this book because I had this fascination for the Four Freedoms, but what really sort of clicked was that in February 1942, Franklin Roosevelt had to tell the American people not to give up because they were having a terrible time. We weren't even in Europe yet, and we were having a terrible time in the Pacific. And his advisor said, you need to go before the American people in a fireside chat. And what he does in that fireside chat, February 23rd, 1942, Washington's birthday weekend, is he recounts Washington's retreat across New Jersey to the Delaware River. And then he tells, after he reviews the entire world scene, he says, Washington had his officers read some lines to his men. This is the way he closed his speech. And it's direct lines from Thomas Paine. And he says, those are the words of Thomas Paine, who spoke for Americans then. Those words speak for us today. And he got letters from all around the country saying, I am so glad that a president of the United States is quoting Thomas Paine.
Well, Thomas Paine had been so badly trashed. I mean, it took Thomas Edison to bring him back.
Yes, right.
He was after he wrote The Age of Reason and basically declared his atheism, he was persona non grata in the United States.
Yeah,
seven people showed up for his funeral.
I hate to correct you, Tom, but
he was
a deist, not an atheist.
Oh, a deist, okay.
Okay, but you know what? We shouldn't forget, in every generation from Paine's day right through to Edison's turn of the century day, every progressive movement in America, the free thinkers, the Working Men's Party, the suffragists, the abolitionists, all populists, progressives, socialists, go right through anarchists, the Haymarket Martyrs, all the way through for 100 years. Every one of those groups, their first revolutionary hero was Thomas Paine.
Right.
And Edison, who was no revolutionary necessarily, but he had this feeling that religion was our biggest problem, he reaches out to Thomas Paine because of the work Age of Reason. Right. But no president from Thomas Jefferson until Jefferson and Paine were friends. But from Jefferson to Franklin Roosevelt, no president, while in office, in a speech, quoted Thomas Paine's name, cited his name, even though they might have used his words, as did Wilson and others.
Right. Because of the Age of Reason.
Because of the Age of Reason, it was this threat to the Christian establishment.
Right, and there was a huge Christian revival. It came around the time...
The Second Great Awakening.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
But the other thing was, and I think this actually carries just as much weight in historical terms, every one of those progressive movements that I mentioned, they raised Thomas Paine's name to the forefront.
Right.
And when, I like to say, the property, the prestigious, the pious, and so on, when they heard Thomas Paine's name, they shivered.
Mm.
They shivered. Because he had also written, don't forget, Rights of Man,
right,
and Agrarian Justice, an argument for social democracy and social security.
Right. Agrarian Justice, not just social security, also basically a guaranteed minimum income.
Right. Right. To give young people a chance to start in life.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. It's every person is basically born like George W. Bush was, with a trust fund.
Right.
As it were. It's pretty amazing. Penny. In Thornton, Colorado, listening on AM 760, you're on the air with Professor Harvey Paine.
Hi,
Harvey K.
Great discussion, by the way. I really appreciate you guys doing this.
Thank you.
My biggest question is, do you think that there's any hope for Obama to change? Because I feel like if he doesn't do it now and we don't make him do it, then we're gonna lose something.
Well, you just said it. Make him do it.
Thank you, Penny.
Make him do it.
Isn't that really the great, I mean, you're an American historian. Isn't that the great lesson of American history, that when the people's ire is up, the leaders...
George Washington used to say bad things about American farmers and workers. Hmm. But he knew he needed them. He knew he needed them in his army, and he knew he needed them to make an independent country. And eventually they made him do it. As president of the United States.
Right.
Lincoln had said, if I could keep the Union together without ending slavery, I'd be more than happy to do it. I'm not sure he said it in those words, but that's the point.
No, it's very close. I just last week, in fact, I've got to print it out here someplace, read his speech in response to Dred Scott. And he was like, everybody knows white people don't like black people, and we're not calling for mixing the races, and I would never say such a thing. And it's like,
but then, as he realized, if we're going to win the Civil War,
Right.
We have got to emancipate Southern blacks, not only to rise up on those plantations, but also to join in the civil right in the civil war on right. the northern
right.
side.
So 5 years later, he does a complete 180.
Right. And then Franklin Roosevelt, he was to Roosevelt's credit, I think Roosevelt had studied that history.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew the trick was to get Americans to push him, to help him say those words, "I welcome their hatred." Right. You know, at one point he said very quickly, you know, they complain we want to overthrow their power. They're right. We do want to overthrow their power. That's
and
what America's about.
And our commitment to American institutions requires the
Thank
overthrow
you.
Of that
exactly.
kind of power.
Thank you.
Absolutely. In fact, we're going to play that probably tonight on the television. Professor Harvey J. K., his new book, The Fight for the Four Freedoms. Prior to that, his book, Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. Do you have any another one?
I have lots of other ones, but I'm more interested in saying thank you very much, Tom, for having me.
Thanks so much for being with us, Harvey. Don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartmann. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartmann.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartmann here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartmann program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.